So, you're not hooked on?
Almost.
No, but...
Because you're kind of... Well, you put it yesterday, you don't know why people keep calling you a legend, but if somebody calls you a legend, there's got to be a reason. And, basically, I don't know, you impressed, I don't know whether you noticed it, but all the students were kind of sitting together and you impressed them tremendously, because the guys were just sitting there going, wow. Number one, you got your degree in 1916? Is that when it was?
1916.
Where was that from?
What?
Where did you get your degree?
University of Washington, College of Mines.
I didn't know they had one there.
Oh, yes, it's a well-known school. It's a... Well, I lived right at home. I was born in Colorado, and as mining, Wild and West mining country, and saloons would run 24 hours a day, and had gambling, roulette, faro, blackjack, all the gambling games, and cowpokes, and great cattle country, and mining country, and the combination was made it a wild and woolly place. And they had stopped carrying guns, except the sheriff and the marshal and a few, but the police, but when they got in an argument, they went someplace and got their guns and went down on Main Street and settled it. And had been a number of hangings around there. The vigilantes had to come in and hang people in order to clean it up, you see. They formed gangs, toughest, just like you have now. In every city, there are gangs, criminal gangs, mafia, and all these others. And so, if we go back to this period when they just got fed up with that, and then they formed the vigilantes, and they take a man, and if he was associating with well-known criminals, or they were pretty sure that he was a criminal, or stole horses, or held up to the stage, or something like that, they took him out and hung him up to a tree or a gallows, and most of the other boys that had ideas like that left town, and they went to the next town, and the next town had a vigilante group that strung up a couple, and they kept on moving, and finally they cleaned them out. Some of them left the West altogether. So I think a vigilante would simplify things in this country right now, in certain areas.
Yeah, I can think of a few places, yeah.
Now a man, no matter what he does, you're arrested, you can get bail, and wouldn't be a bad idea to hang a few lawyers along with him.
Yep.
I've told friends that whenever they issue a law degree, they ought to issue him a suspended period of using it for 30 years before he can go practicing law. Maybe he'd circulate around and get a lot of experience in how people live and how some people are honest and others are not. Then he'd make a good lawyer if after 30 years of practical experience he'd start practicing law. I have a young fellow over to mine now. He home was Maine, and he went to Amherst College and he studied law. But he didn't think too much of it. He didn't finish his degree, and he went west and came to Alaska. And he had a job here in Fairbanks working as a white collar man and a church suggester. He says to himself, my salary is way below what you're paying up on the pipeline. So he just quit his job and went to work on the pipeline, and he worked several years there and saved his money, and he's got a garbage can full of De Niro now, and he met a young woman who was a graduate of Kansas University. She saved her money, and she had worked as a stenographer and as a clerk in various work, and even as a cook. She could cook. And she saved her dough, and now they're happily ensconced over at Stampede. He had been in there to visit, and he liked it so well. We're right next to McKinley Park, you see, right adjoining, and the National Park Service wants to take me into their park, and with no respect to mineral values and all that. You're taking mining in, and a lot of people, you know, they have no realization that minerals are what run the wheels of government. So he liked it so well that after he and Linda left the place, they came over. He asked me if I'd sell him a piece of ground. I have some patented ground. I have more ground being patented. And you have to fight like everything to get a patent to mining ground, because Bureau of Land Management makes it just as difficult as possible for you. You have to establish a valid discovery, and you have to establish values that a prudent man could make a profit at operating it. You can't just stake a piece of ground because you hope there's values in it. You have to sink down or dig on it, dig a trench, or open it up and prove you've got a vein or ore deposit. Now this vein that this man is worried about, it's 95 feet to bedrock, I found. And a man, a guy who had cooked for me the year before, he didn't want to live in town and cost money. This was years and years ago, and his wages were only about, $90 a month or so. And he wanted to save it until spring. And so he asked me if I could live in an old cabin down in the flats, and I said sure, to help himself. And he said he'd like to do some exercise, sink a shaft there. And I said, sure, go ahead. I don't own the cabin. I said, somebody else built it. It's not on ground that I own. And he asked me how deep the bedrock, and I said, I don't know, maybe 40 feet or so. Well, he sank the shaft down 25 feet, and he went to town, and he got a friend to come out and help him windlass, and they dug, and they borrowed the windlass from me. And finally, Jack says, I'm through there. I had got to bedrock, and there's nothing there but a bunch of old quartz boulders at the bottom. course, my ears went up. And sure enough, I went down to take the windlass away, and I was going down the shaft first and look at it. And I could see those vein course, good crisp course. I didn't look at it too close. I was in a hurry and threw some in the dog sled basket. And the gas was so bad I couldn't go down there. This carbon dioxide gas, decomposed vegetation, comes out when the barometric pressure is low. It was boiling out of the collar of the shaft. No chance of going down. Candle or match would go right up 6 inches from the surface, pouring out of the, like water. And so I threw it onto the windlass on there and took it home with a few pieces of the vein quartz and threw it off at the bunkhouse, and I was so hurry I didn't even look at it. 2 or 3 months later, I picked it up, showed it to a miner that was standing in front of the bunkhouse. I said, there's a vein down there in the flat someplace. He says, yes, gosh, he says, look at the gold in it. There were specks of gold all through it. Then I really got interested. But it was springtime then, and Jack wasn't working for me. He was cooking for Joe Henderson. Do you know where Joe Henderson mine on Nestor Dome?
Yes.
Well, he was cooking for Joe, and I went up there, stopped there, and I says, Jack, there's a good gold vein in, over in there for you in that shaft. You better stake it. No, no, I don't want it. He says, he's an Irishman. Well, it's rich enough that it's justify your staking. No, no, I don't want to have anything to do with court. Well, do you any, have you any objection if I stake? Go ahead. So I located this claim, and then that fall I cleaned the shaft out and sloughed in a lot and found all this vein quartz in the bottom. And we had to drift on bedrock quite a bit to find the vein. It, the quartz had worked downhill, which it does. Float doesn't travel uphill. And we found it and staked two claims. And all these years have gone through since then. Now this has come back to me for, you want information about it. Well, what else do you want to know besides that little story?
Well, that was interesting. Well, I guess we ought to continue. You graduated from the University of Washington. Thing, Dean Bison was talking about that special corps, whatever, that you were in the Army?
It was the 27th Engineers, a mining regiment, the only mining regiment in the Army. And at the beginning of the war, they had, the Italians were on our side in World War I. They weren't a heck of a lot of help, but they weren't doing it any hard, but we had to go over there on that river, valley, I forget the name, during the war, and rush troops of English and French and American to stop the onrush of the Heine coming down that valley. Or they'd have conquered it in a few days, but anyway, the Austrians were on the German side, of course, and the Austrian Alps, they had fortifications and the I think it was the English had tunnel in under there and under some Austrian fortifications, and without their knowing it, they hit the rock drill too. You'd think they'd discovered it. Somebody was hammering away down below there, but they couldn't put roads on rock drills. But anyway, they did drive in under there and blew the top of this fortifications off. And that's what we were to do. And the regiment was recruited. It was a volunteer outfit. There's no draft men. I was at that time with a mining company in British Columbia as engineer, and when the United States got into the war, I was holding that job. And I could have stayed up there and claimed, you know, what they did in Vietnam, but I didn't. I told the president of the company, I said, I'm going down and enlist in the American Army. And he said, Earl, if you stay with us, I'll claim exemption for you. And I said, I don't want exemption. If I take exemption, I'll be ashamed of myself the rest of my life. So I waited until I had broken in some men to run this mill. The man that was building the mill had got sick. He was a Coeur d'Alene mill man, and I had to build that mill. I just a young fellow. Had to finish the construction and do the engineering and little assaying that was necessary. And that was fine. I had lots of work to keep me busy and helping. But I broke in a man on the mill, and I went down and took the boat to on Lake Kootenay to the railroad at the south end of the lake. It's a long lake, about 80 or 90 miles long. And came down to the U.S. and enlisted in the 27th Mining Engine. Army. But in France, we didn't do any mining. Things were plenty busy in Europe, not in the Alps. So a third of this regiment were over 41, I think that was the age of enlistment. They lied about their ages to get in. They were miners and from mining camps all over the West and from other countries, and young engineers. I had a good friend, he and I were both sent to across the ocean back to Les États-Unis to be trained for engineer officers in 1918, and he had quit a job in India as resident manager of a copper mine, an open pit copper mine, mining native copper, and had enlisted. He told me how they treated him over there. Every morning there was a railroad track ran from his residence up the valley about a half a mile, and every morning early there would be four stalwart men with a push car out on the track early waiting there for him to finish his breakfast and go out and sit on this car and be pushed up to where the open pit mine was going, and he would sit there and watch them, and then he'd, when he went in the office, the head clerk would yell in Indian language the words of attention, and everybody'd stand up, and he'd be escorted back to his office. He was just a kid, and the clerk would explain to him in English, and this paper had to be signed, and he'd dip the pen in the ink and hand it to him, and all he had to do is sign his name, and paper after paper, and then he'd go back to his residence, and there's a boy there to wait on him who was old enough to be his father, and he was living like that, and he quit that to come over and come home and enlist in the 27th Engineer. So it was a good regiment. I figured that a third of us were young engineers and a third of us were ordinary age. Most of those men were miners, practical miners with experience. And the other third that were older guys that knew mining from A to Z and had lied about their age. And there was in C Company, I think it was, a man named Hardy from Nevada, and his son enlisted with him, both of them together, in the same outfit. Well, all they did, they were transferred to building heavy bridges, and they were good bridges. You see, every bridge was wrecked as Heine retreated, and so we had to build bridges fast enough to keep the doughboys coming. A lot of those bridges had to be built heavy enough to support 40-ton tanks. They had tanks in.
That's, you know, kind of typical Army Corps of Engineers, though, that they can retrain you. That's what they offered to do to me, is retrain me and teach me how to build roads.
Yeah. If you're a bookkeeper, they put you out on pick and shovel. If you were pick and shovel stiff, they put you on bookkeeping, something like that.
Chuck Herbert was talking about, he was a mining engineer, so they had him blowing up ships.
Yeah. One time, I remember, that was in the 27th. I wasn't so smart. Bill Waters, stocky belt guy, he was a wrestler in college, but he wasn't any hot taller than me. So we were in the same squad as privates. And, well, he was an acting corporal, and I was a private. This sergeant, top sergeant, he says, he knew if there was so many mining engineers in there. He says, all you mining engineers, one pace forward. And I was going to step out, and Bill says, stand fast. So I stood there, and all the rest of the mining engineers stepped out, and a sneer came over the sergeant's face. Says, all you mining engineers, report to this supply sergeant for picks and shovels. The rest of the company fall out. Bill and I went in and laid on our bunks and talked and kidded and everything else. So that's about the way it was. Thank you. got back from the military, I was in Seattle, and I stole my uniform, and I saw a man in the window selling stock in the mining enterprise. And I listened to his line, and I said, you're all wrong on that. I said, you've got a mill as plans, but the mill is for a coal washing plant, not for treating lead silver ore. They had claimed to have a vein up in Okanagan County, Washington. And he says, ask me more about it. And so it ended up, they offered me a job. And I stayed with them a while, and I says, you better go up and find out about this vein if it's what you say it is. They had a report of somebody that carried it. Oh, I forget. 8% lead, and it's several percent lead and silver and some zinc. All right, too. I'd worked in the Coeur d'Alene and lead zinc, and I knew about that. And so we went up to investigate, and they had taken this property. It had a shaft about feet deep, and we had to dewater it. It was high up in it. So we bailed the water out of there, didn't use a pump, just bailed it with a team of horses. Got the water down so I could get down there at midnight, something like that, start sampling. I guarded those samples, kept them under my bed until I got them on the tray and assayed them. They carried about 10% of what their statement was. So I left that outfit and I got a job in Northern Nevada with a little gold mine at a 5-cent mill. And I was with them for several months. I was married right after the war. This young lady, when I went away, I didn't figure I'd get married and come back minus a couple of legs or something. Or leave her a widow or pregnant mother or something, or a baby, so I postponed marriage until I was back. And I got married in my uniform. Anyway, this mine was a pretty good little mine. It had an aerial tram, and it's an elevation mine at about 9,000 feet, and trammed it down to the mill about 900 feet lower elevation, and it was a 5-cent amalgamation mill. I guess you know by now what that is.
Yep.
And when winter came, we shut down, and I went to Salt Lake City, and we went to Salt Lake City, and had no job, but on the way I had heard about the fine gold in the Snake River. So I stopped there and got about a 100-pound sample in the sack of this fine gold, this Snake River. I told him about these last couple of years, or maybe 2.5 years, when I studied metallurgical ore treatment of some Mexican ores, leaching it with hypos salts. These oxidized ores, you could leach them with sodium hyposulfate, and it dissolves the silver. Then you can add impure sodium sulfate, or sulfate, and it brings it back to hyposulfate so that for leaching again. And that's the same reaction that takes place in photographic studios. They dissolve the silver off of the film, and at that time the studios, when a tank of hypo got used up, they run it into sewer. And I inquired around. This was in Seattle, and Seattle was not a big city then. It was well large, about the same size compared to the other city, but they've all grown to meet demand. And I found that I could get that hypo for nothing, most of them that use hypo. And all I needed was a bunch of 5-gallon carboys, and I could go down. They'd call me up, or I'd know about when it was used up, and inquire, and I'd take my car. Wasn't every boy that had an automobile either. And drive down with about 6 of those 5-gallon glass jars. And I'd siphon the hypo out of their wooden tank. One of them was up in the Lohman building, where I had 8 or 10 stories running down the elevator. But I'd take that home and I'd dump it in a big oak cask that held about close to 100 gallons. And then I'd dump in some of this fertilizer, which was the same chemical, which I could get cheap enough, to precipitate silver sulfate. And when that built up in the bottom of the cask, I could drain off the top, take it out, dry it in the sun, or build a fire in the backyard. Mother wouldn't let me do that in the house.
Yeah.
And then I drive over to Tacoma. The roads weren't too good then between Seattle and Tacoma. Now they...
When was this?
Oh, this is 1914, 15. Anyway, it wasn't all paved. One track road here. And I figured I made $15 an hour for the time I worked on it. Mm. And about $75 a month. And that was a good pay for a kid going to school. There weren't any handouts for students in those days. I never knew anybody that got an allotment because he was a good high school student or anything like that. He earned his way, or his folks put up the money for him. And I lived at home most of the time, but I belong to a fraternity, but I still earned most of my money. Well, I earned all of the money I had, all through the university. And I went out and worked in the summers, mining it. Like, I worked one summer up Treadwell Mines down under the ocean, 1,700 feet below sea level, and out under the ocean, but there was a miner. And another summer I'd spent in the Coeur d'Alenes. I couldn't get work underground as a miner, but I picked apples and fruit, peaches, and everything.
Cleaning out houses.
Yeah. Well, that's all. How do you earn your way through school now?
Actually, I work in the library.
You do?
Yeah. Gives me a little bit of money.
Do you get any help from your folks?
No, down in my hometown, there's a bank that provides student loans, and we get so much a year.
Where's your hometown?
Virginia.
Virginia?
Yes.
What part of Virginia?
Fredericksburg.
One branch of my family started in Virginia.
Oh, really? Where?
I've got a cousin at... why did that slip my mind? No, Western Virginia. There's a school, a military school. Gosh, I know it so well. I've been there.
I know the place. I can't think of it either.
Sarah Souter is her name. And our family, that branch of family, were Andersons. And the Andersons were Scotch. You hardly believe that, but way back when those Viking boys lived over there in Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, it was only a little row across the channel from Denmark. And they'd sit around their fire and they'd say, what do we do to kill time? And they'd say, well, let's go over there to Scotland or Ireland and nail off some of those good-looking girls and bring them home.
Uh-huh.
And some of them stayed over there. Some of these Anderson, there's an Andersonville in North Ireland. If you hear these stories about the war between the Catholics and the Protestants and all that, some of it often centers around Andersonville. Well, the King of England, I mean, he didn't think much of the Catholics for some reason or other, and he moved a lot of these Scotsmen, so-called Scotsmen, down into North Ireland and gave them land. He wouldn't let the Catholics own land. They weren't people. They were good people. And they were still fighting then, I guess, or were fighting then, because this William Anderson, I've got all this. My cousin Sarah Souter, she has it all down and traced it back in Virginia. The name almost went through right too fast to pick it off. The mother and four sons migrated to North America, And the king gave William Anderson 500 acres of land in Western Virginia. And the time was late in somewhere around the 1690s. And this Sarah is still living on part of that original 500 acre grant. And she told me that she can't find the graves of the original people. But has the genealogy traced down, except there was a blank spot in there. My father, who was named Harvey Anderson, with that Anderson name, which they valued quite highly, Pilgrim, he told me once that to go to this place, that I'd find relatives there named Anderson. So one time in a few years ago, I drove over. I was down in D.C. to testify at some Senate hearings on minerals. I got to know the District of Columbia quite well, and I got to know a lot of the congressmen and senators. So I took another cousin who lived in D.C., a direct cousin. We, two cousins, two women, and we drove over there and arrived on Sunday morning. I went to the police department because I figured all the other places would be closed. Told the desk sergeant that I'll get you the name for that town, and that I wanted to look up Anderson's, and the relationship. And so he started telephoning. He knew the town. It's not a very big city. Finally, a man came down there who was supposed to be an old-timer, knew everybody, gray-haired gentleman. And he made two or three telephone calls, and he finally latched onto this Mrs. Souter. She says she was delighted that she wanted to meet me because she had a vacant spot in this family. And a lieutenant of police drove ahead of us to guide us out to this place on the outskirts of Stanton, Virginia.
Okay.
Here was her family out on the porch, her husband and all, a nice brick house, and two or three children. And we compared notes and everything else, and she was just delighted. So they showed us all around the place. Everything going right back to the first land grant that William had received of 500 acres, and they measured, you had surveying, I guess.
Yeah.
Instead of measuring in chains or feet, I've got a copy of it over at home. Over to mine. That's my home. I have a kind of a semi-home down in Kirkland, Washington, at my nephew's place on Lake Washington. He has a beautiful place, and he's owned his own twin engine Cessna. He was a World War II pilot, and he owns his motorboat on the lake and has a boathouse right there. And the house slopes right down into the lake. Beautiful. But he's dissatisfied all the time with everything. His wife says that I am a good influence to him because I don't get so dissatisfied with everything. I had a temper like everything. It don't do you any good. I always get into bloody noses when I was a kid. Defending my dog's virtuosity and this and that. Fighting over such things as marbles and all that. Mother sent me to Sunday school once when I was a little tyke with my white blouse waist and my knee pants, and give me a kiss and sent me off to Sunday school. On the way here was some kids playing marbles, and some guy makes a sarcastic remark at me, and me, instead of going on my way, I resented it. And pretty soon I was going home very slowly and sadly, my white blouse all covered with dirt and a black eye. And I had got some blood on my beautiful blouse. I couldn't take the other guy home to show him how he looked. Anyway, you can just imagine how Mother felt. I don't know why mothers ever want to waste their time raising kids, but they do. Well, coming back to what were we talking about? Suitor. Anyway, I gave her a lot of information by correspondence and other, and I'll have a copy of that award that Pearl gave me last night. Did you see this?
I didn't see that part.
Gathered all those in because I didn't give him any information.
He's got some pretty good sources.
I guess so. They must keep a record because of the faculty, after they sever connections.
You know, archives probably would in the alumni office.
Maybe that's it. Maybe they do keep track of me as a legend or something, but I... I thought a legend was some kind of an imaginary person or something.
No.
Anyway, I have had good health, and it's no credit to me, because I don't ever live healthy. I smoked cigarettes for a good many years. I smoke cigars once a week. Now I don't smoke every day like I used to, but I take a drink. I don't believe in health food. I eat any doggone thing that comes rolling along.
Yeah.
I eat what I want to, and I don't have to worry about getting fat.
That's nice.
I do notice that this January, when I got back after 6 weeks residence down there, that my work trousers had shrunk at the waist a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't be that I was in increased weight or size or anything like that. Anyway, I have never had an illness. Had the scarlet fever when I was 7. Or no, I was about 4. And I nearly died from that. And I had measles and mumps and those things that kids have. I spent 3 weeks in a military hospital. That one sickness. And I didn't get along, and I don't feel that I'm going to have any trouble making 100 years, unless a grizzly bear takes me over there or something
right.
Like that, or I get run over in the city. But and it doesn't seem to be that I'm doing anything wonderful, but I guess that people think so. I know it's most people, they do. The man does bump off. This young fellow with the mine there, he's a big, strong guy, and he's real careful about his food. He eats health food, and then he eats health food. And I eat any, whatever I want to eat that's happened to be available. Right now, the way we are, they eat up in their cabin and I batch. But I eat bacon and eggs, and they're supposed to be hard on cholesterol, but I've had checks made and I don't have any quantity of cholesterol. And I kind of question whether these doctors are all correct in their diagnosis. You eat a lot of cholesterol, maybe you develop some, but if you just eat a normal amount, maybe it doesn't bother you. Maybe some people have a built-in organization that eliminates some of that cholesterol. But the thing that I think is contributes to my health, I've lived rough, I've slept with wet clothes, and I've worked in gassy places, and I had lots of dust on my lungs from drilling dry underground, silicosis they call it. And yet that's going away. I know the doctor showed me some general checkup not too long ago. I had a lung x-ray, and I had another one 2 or 3 years later. I was wanted to take out another annuity at 82 or 83, and so I want to have a good. And the insurance man in Seattle, he thought it kind of odd that a guy 83 would take out an annuity, which is a gamble that you're going to make money on. And had this Equitable company, and they also had two other annuities that I'd taken out, and I didn't have any children or anybody to take care of when I die, so why not invest in another annuity? So this wasn't much, but I wanted to put $5,000 into it. I had a treasury certificate. At the end of 20 years, you can... These treasury notes you can collect on them for 20 years and then so much in months, and then at the... When it's either all used up, you can cash it in for $5,000. I could buy another one if I could get a bank to sell me one, or I thought, why not throw that into another annuity? And this agency helped me made out the deal and put the equitable people wrote to me and wanted to copy my birth certificate. And I wrote, says, I have an affidavit, but I don't have it here. I'll have to wait till I can get to Seattle. It's in my strong box down there. So in time, I sent it to him. I didn't send the original. I sent a copy of it. And during World War II, I couldn't. I had to have a birth certificate to operate my radio station over to mine. And I couldn't find any records in Durango, Colorado, where I'd born, because they didn't keep records. Either that was burned down or something. And after months of correspondence and all that, they said that if I could just get an affidavit signed by people who were present when I was born. Well, that is simple. My father and mother were both living. So
sure were.
So they dutifully prepared an affidavit that they were present when I was born and sent it, and that's, they accepted that. But they thought that any guy 82 or 3 taking out an annuity must be trying to swindle us somewhere, because that pays back in less than 7 years, you see. And if you live up more than 7 years, it's all velvet from then on. You're winning that. You put your money on the red mark on a roulette wheel and you won a pot full.
Sure. Okay.
So maybe when I'm 90, I'll try and get another annuity. See what they say.
Well, they'll love it. By this time they should be expecting it. Anyhow, how'd you end up up here?
What's that?
How did you end up here again? I missed that story last night. I missed out on the beginning of it.
Well, I had worked one summer in Alaska. Naturally, all young people are... How did you come here from Virginia? You just wanderlust. You wanted, I presume that is it, you wanted, or did you want to go specifically to the University of Alaska?
Yeah, that's why I came up.
Well, I wanted to work in this famous Treadwell mine, one of the famous gold mines in the world at that time, right on Douglas Island, across from Juneau, and it dips down under the ocean, the channel, and the main runs along the shore there for at least 3 miles, and I worked that summer there. 4 months, in fact, we stayed. Had a heck of a job after I got back to school. I intended to stay away a year and work there, but Rick Wills, a good friend of mine, a buddy, he was a member of the varsity crew, University of Washington. In those days, had the best crews in the United States, college crew. And Brick was on a true that spring that had eroded Poughkeepsie and the arc against Wisconsin, Harvard, Pennsylvania, all that. Anyway, Washington had the best record overall ever has in crew.